Hello, everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author to Author, where we talk about writing in life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. Right now, new issue is up, and we've got interview with Graham Simsion, who wrote The Rosie Project, fascinating conversation, interesting guy. Check it out, authormagazine.org. And we're funded by the wonderful Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. It's been 60-plus years they've been doing that. You can learn more about the PNWA at pnwa.org. Check it out. Just to let you know, if you are interested, we've got I've just created a Fearless Writing Tutorial with Writer's Digest. It's just up now and available for the low, low price of $16.99, I believe. And that is available online through Writer's Digest. You can find the link for this little tutorial on my website. It's all over my website, front page, Fearless Writing page. It is, if you want to be soothed by my dulcet tones, you can listen to this and watch a little video we put together. That's on my homepage. Also, I will be teaching a Fearless Writing workshop on August 19th. If you're in the Pacific Northwest, particularly down in the Port Townsend area, I will be at the Writer's Workshop in Port Townsend on August 19th, teaching a half-day Fearless Writing workshop. You can find that on my website, williamknauer.com. Also, all right. Well, I don't talk about it much on this show, but the truth is, this is a little secret of mine, I was as influenced as a young artist by Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck, Monty Python, Saturday Night Live, Steve Martin, all these comedians. Comedy was a huge part of my growing up and the sort of my own artistic development, which is why I am so pleased to have today's guest on the show, Nate Dern, who is a senior writer at the fabulous website Funny or Die and the former artistic director of the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in New York City. He appeared in the Palo Sorrento film Youth and the TV shows Boardwalk Empire and Gossip Girl. He is his writing has been published in The New Yorker, McSweeney's, Outside, Vice, New York Magazine, and others, and as of today, boys and girls, he is the author of the book Not Quite a Genius. Nate, are you really not quite a genius? I think, well, we all are. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, first of all, congratulations. You're a book author as of this day, today.
It's very exciting. My wife had a dream last night that I died, and I'm worried that it's a sign that I've done what I came here on Earth to do, and now
I'm not ready to go yet.
That omen might be.
That is so funny. Let me ask you this. So you've obviously published pieces in a number of wonderful periodicals, but it was a book part of your young man's dreams for yourself, or was that not in your scope at all? Was it more the stage or the screen?
It was absolutely a dream. I've loved books since I was very young, but I think about since high school, it kind of became a top lifelong goal.
So
it really has been ever since then. Big day.
Well, that's great. And so I guess, was this the first book you ever sat down to write?
It's not. I've pitched a couple other humor books before that were more of the, like, gimmick variety, I guess you could say, more aiming to be like a coffee table book that would be sold at Urban Outfitters or something like that. So I went through the process once or twice before where I put together a proposal and sent out sample pages to publishers and agents, and that those ideas ultimately didn't go anywhere.
Right.
But this was the time that I put together, kind of looked at what I'd already written and put it together, trying to make it into like a manuscript and just put it all into a Word doc, basically all the humor pieces and personal essays that I'd written over the last decade, and threw away the ones that I thought were too terrible, then the ones that I felt okay about I kept in, and then I just looked at the word count, and not in terms of quality, but just in terms of quantity. I was like, all right, well, it's long enough to be a book. I don't know if it's good enough, but that's at least a start. So I sent that out from there. Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting format you chose. So for listeners, Not Quite a Genius is a collection of a lot of pieces. It's really, I have to tell you, kind of a staggering number of small pieces, because each piece is complete in its own idea and its own little beginning, middle, and end. So there is that. But many of them are what you would call fiction or sketches, essentially, but for the page. And then some are, as you said, personal essays. And each section kind of contains a lead personal. So it's a very unusual book. I don't think I can – I can't really think of another book that has that blend of personal – of fiction and nonfiction. Was that a tough sell? Did people get
that? Yeah, I think you're probably right. Well, initially it was only fiction, and then my publisher, my editor at the publisher, Ben Lonan, who's an editor at Simon Schuster, he had the suggestion of trying to include some more personal essays in it, which I was initially shy about doing. So those were added later on. I was worried that I wasn't interesting, or also worried about coming across as navel gazing.
Yeah.
So all of those things. I've loved some personal essay books that have come out recently. You know, David Sedaris, obviously.
Sure.
And also Lena Dunham. And I think Lena's most recent book has a few pieces in it that are closer to the type of short humor that I do, but they're still, for the most part, all about her. So even that book doesn't have just the complete absurd fiction that this one does. I think it is an unusual mishmash of styles. So I think the hope is it'll keep your interest, because each piece is different from one to the next. But then, the worry is we'll see if it feels like a cohesive entity or not.
Well, I have to tell you that I love the personal essay. It's kind of my thing. That's what I seem to have landed on, much to my own surprise. I thought I started out writing fiction, but I've moved on to that. And I thought your personal essays were great. Very tight. No, really, they were. And I read both things. I do love just comedy in its pure form. But I thought I would read a book of essays by this guy in a moment, honestly. So
thank you so much.
It's nice that you're humble, but there was no navel gazing that I noticed, and I thought they were they had a great structure to them. Not to get too technical, but there was a real completeness that's not always easy to pull off in the personal essay. So well done, well done.
I really appreciate that. That's so great to hear. I was very worried about them, so I spent the most time on them. For better or worse, I think with some of the humor pieces, probably I might have had the opinion, well, either you'll think this is funny or you won't.
Right.
Whereas with the personal essays, I was so worried about getting those right that I definitely really worried over them and spent a lot of time on them. And I, as you said, I really love the form, and kind of I've ended up surprising myself. And since the manuscript was due, you know, over a year ago now, I've written a few new pieces for Outside Magazine and New York Magazine in that personal essay format, and I really love it. I have a new appreciation for it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot you can do with it, and you could be funny, you can be profound, you can be revelatory. I think it's a great format. But I think I got to tell you, you have the skill of the comedian, which I think the comedian has to keep – the humor has to keep coming. There can't be lag, really. And you see, that seems to help with a sense of pacing. Does that make sense?
Yes.
You can't really lag.
I know what you mean.
And so maybe just for our listeners, so I gave your background, but a lot of your artistic life began as a mix of for – you write now for Funny or Die, which of course is for the, I guess we call it the small screen. And,
right.
And then for the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, which I have known of, never got to see, but I so fell in love with the name of it that I feel like I did see it. But and so, but that was for the stage, I assume, yeah?
Correct.
And so what is the, for you, what's the difference between working in those formats and working on the page, just the page?
Yeah, well, so my first comedy home right out of college was at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, which is an improv comedy and sketch theater. So I was taking classes there in New York City, and I'd written humor before, but I had no strategy for it. I was all over the place.
Right.
So UCB really helped to give me a strategy for just how am I going to try to be funny in a more systematic way. And so that, even though it was for performance, improv mainly, I think just having any coherent plan for comedy was so helpful that then I took that to the writing that I do on my own. So even for people who aren't necessarily performers, I'd recommend, if you're looking to kind of give your comedy a little shape, to try improv at UCB or a different theater in your town.
So they do sketch comedy, but you were on, man, improv always just feels like flying without a net. So talk to me about that. I mean, I marvel at the people who are so good at it. When you say you were looking to give it a shape, what do you mean by that?
Yeah,
what does that mean to
you?
What
it means to me is that, because sometimes people will ask, like, well, how do you, if it's all made up on the spot, how do you practice improv or how do you study improv? And I kind of think
right.
of it like sport, like sports, which is that, like an analogy that I've heard other improv teachers use is that when a basketball team goes into a game, they know if they're going to have a man-to-man defense or if they're going to have a zone defense. And so even though the game itself is improvised from play to play, they're responding from moment to moment, they have a basic strategy. And I think improv is like that. So we at UCB, they teach something called game, which is that any scene should only have one unusual thing, and then you heighten it from there.
Right. You know, I was thinking about that as I was reading your sketches.
Mm-hmm.
In the fictional parts, which is that generally speaking, like sketch comedy has usually one joke, one conceptual joke
right.
in it, but then
right.
you have to turn it and take it somewhere, right?
Right. Yeah.
And that's
so
always, to me, the biggest challenge, and where sketches seem to me to fall short is when they don't turn anywhere.
I think you're right. Yeah. I always start with the one premise, and basically I'm very mathematical about it, and I just try to get the logic of the piece all down. So just the basic structure of I start with this and then I heighten from there. And then in all the rewriting, it's trying to punch it up with those surprising jokes, or ideally if I can take it to a new place that feels like it was earned to go there and isn't just out of the blue for the sake of being out of the blue, then those
right.
are always the strongest pieces.
Yeah. I was watching an interview with Woody Allen, and they were asking mm-hmm. about his creative process, and he said, well, basically, I just try to delight myself when I sit down
mm-hmm.
to write. Does that resonate with you in terms of making yourself laugh, making yourself, finding yourself delighted by what you've put down?
That definitely resonates with me for the idea phase. So when I'm just out
uh-huh.
in my life and something strikes me as funny and delights me, I'll write it down. So like a piece I'm working on right now, an example is that I misread when the cheese was expiring in my fridge, and I thought it said it was
uh-huh.
expiring like 20 years from now. And that, for some reason, that just tickled me. Cheese that didn't expire for a long time. And so I'm working on a piece right now that's the cheese that never expired. It's just like a real inspirational piece. So the initial thing delighted me out, you know, truly delighted me. But then once I'm actually writing in front of my laptop, I become much more analytical. And it's much, to me, much less like, am I delighted so much as staring at it really hard and trying to see if the math of it works, which you can't always do. But that's how I do it.
Funny. So the math of it, I think I know what you mean. Of course, there's the old rule of threes, but I think you mean more than that.
Correct.
What
is the math of it to you? Yeah. I think, like, maybe a better way to put it might be just the logic of it. Like, if this is the thing that I find absurd about this premise, why is it absurd? And then trying to expose it in different ways, almost like a philosophical logic. Like, if this is true, then this other thing must be true too. And kind of seeing like an initial, if you can convince the audience, like, or convince the reader to get on board for something that's only a little bit absurd, but then, like, well, you already agreed to that logic, so you have to agree to this. I mean,
right. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, because humor is so much, I always think that, like, there's two routes to reality, to understanding life. One is sort of what I think of as poetry, one is humor, but in a way they're both doing the same thing, which is they're trying to help the audience see life from a perspective they hadn't thought of previously, so they can see it anew. I mean, isn't that the ultimate? I mean, that's what humor has to be grounded. It has to be some truth in it, or else it really kind of falls apart.
Yeah, I think so. And my favorite humor, you know, comes from writers like George Saunders or Kurt Vonnegut, who I think take something ordinary and then do force you to look at it in a way you haven't seen it before, or flip something on its head, and you're like, oh my gosh, it is, that thing is like that, isn't that? We all do, yeah.
Well, it also kind of takes I know that in my family, one of the ways I learned to, quote, write was to sit around with my family and tell stories. And we told different kinds of stories, but for sure the biggest win was if I could get my whole family laughing. And I always felt like humor can, at its best, take the teeth out of the perceived teeth in life, meaning what's frightening or uncertain or maybe unacceptable, it makes it friendlier and more palatable in this way. That was my experience. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's not that bad.
Say that again?
In other words, things are not as bad as you first thought.
Gotcha. Yes, I think so. Yeah, I was just rereading Kurt Vonnegut's sort of memoir, Man Without a Country, and he talks about he thinks that all humor is in response to fear. And he says, even like a popsicle stick joke, you know, some corny pun, he says even that, in between the setup and the punchline, you're afraid that you're going to look stupid because you don't know the answer. And then when the person reveals the joke, there's like a relief in like, oh my goodness, it wasn't my fault for not knowing the answer. It was just a joke. And then you laugh with relief, and then he extrapolates out from there that all humor is rooted in dissipating fear. And you could probably think of counterexamples, but I think it's an interesting way to think about it, certainly.
I think it might be true. I think there's something to that, because there is a release. Yeah. There is a, because you need to create a tension and then a release. The laughter is always, my wife always describes it as when the audience puts the wires together.
Yes, that's a great way to put it.
Right, and then poof. In fact, you got a really fun piece in there where a guy's on the phone trying to get his he's got a license plate. It's a very funny piece, Nate, I got to say. But the brilliance of it, so I'm going to quickly, because this goes to my point, which is it only gives one side of the conversation. The guy who's talking to a man, he's trying to get a man to change his license plate. But he only, so it's like almost like a written like a television bit, because you like a Bob Newhart thing where you only hear one person, he only shows one person talking. And the pleasure in that is, the real humor, or part of the humor, comes from us understanding what was being said to him without you ever having to say it. And so I thought a while ago, I'm curious to hear what you think, that humor, that the comedian begins the joke but the audience finishes the joke when they laugh. That's when they finished what the comedian didn't say. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly right. Like, going back to at the beginning, you mentioned Steve Martin as one of your influences, and I think he's a great example of that. And in his memoir, Born Standing Up, he talks about he came to a similar realization where he realized his job is just to build attention, but then the laugh comes when the audience chooses to relieve the tension. And sometimes it can be when the comedian like gives you the punchline and here it is. But then he found the strongest was when they chose when to relieve the tension themselves. And either when they come to the realization, like connect the wires, like you said, or sometimes I think it just, in his case, the absurdity of whatever he's doing gets to be too much. So seeking that relief, they just decide to start laughing.
Well, and it's a funny thing with, like, you know, there's the old thing, you can't explain a joke. When I teach writing, one of the things I do is I tell this joke, and some people get it and some people don't. And the people who get it laugh instantly. And then I have them explain to the people who didn't get it. And, of course, it takes 15 or 20 or 30 seconds to explain it, and, of course, it's never funny. And the comedian's challenge, which I think is sort of every artist's challenge, is how do I say just enough so that they'll get it, but not so much that I'm doing the work for them, but not so little that it's all just there's nothing there. And there's no fine line for that, or there's no science for that.
Yeah, exactly. That's the tension between saying too much but not saying enough. And then with I've now, you know, I put pieces online, like on the New Yorker Daily Shouts or McSweeney's. And so in the connected age we live in, I'll get feedback sometimes from readers. And you know, I've gotten emails where people are offended by a piece. And it's interesting because their takeaway is the exact opposite of the point I was trying to make. So in that case, I'm like, oh, gosh, well, I failed because I did, or did I fail because I didn't say enough? But also, if I was more explicit, I don't think that would accomplish it either. So anyway, all of that is just to say it is an interesting challenge to get your point across or convey your meaning without saying too much.
But you bring up something that I think is profound, and I deal with it a lot. So I teach writing. I teach something called fearless writing, which is really the vast emotional challenges of sharing your work with strangers who all have their own opinions about things. And often I think just that basic challenge it just keeps a lot of people from writing the stuff they want to write. And, you know, when you're writing for if you're performing for an audience and there's 100 of them and 70 of them laugh, your experience is of laughter. You don't pay attention to the 30 who don't. But if one person sends you a message saying, you blew it, this isn't funny, I know because I didn't laugh, it might hit you even harder in a way. And you have to learn to let that go, where you would be easy to let it go if you were on stage, if other people were laughing. You know?
Interesting. It's like because if 100 people – I guess it's maybe because the people who, you know, read the piece and smiled and then just moved on with their day, you don't get any of that feedback. But someone who took the time out of their day to research your email address on your website and send you an email letting you know that they didn't like it, they not only didn't like it, but really put that much energy into letting you know.
What do you do with that?
It's interesting.
Does that hit you?
I do. I have a thin skin, so it does hit me. But then I love it, though. I think it's fascinating. And I do try to learn from it and say, oh, wow, that's what you took away from that. That's so interesting. And try not to be discouraged. I wouldn't ever want to get to the point where I was afraid to put something out there because I was worried about that. But I like it. All in all, I think it's a good thing that we're
sharing connected. Our stuff.
Exactly.
Well, everybody, you know, I know one of the things you have to learn when you have a book is that every reader, like there's the book you wrote and you have your experience of it and your experience has to do with the creating of it. And it's very unique to you. No one will ever experience the book the way you did. And then every single reader is going to have a totally different experience of the book. And it's so strange, Nate. You almost have to give it to them, saying, all right, now this belongs to you. I know I wrote it, but it's not mine anymore. Here.
Yeah.
Take it. Even though you were the one toiling over it.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. And this is my first book, and so I'm definitely going to have to learn how to do that. How do you do that?
Well, you know what it was? I realized when I published some – my things are kind of inspirational – And people would come to me. Often I would hear from people who were inspired by it. And they'd say, oh, thank you.
Okay.
I liked this or that about it. And my impulse was, oh, they liked something different than I did. Or my first thought was they liked it for the wrong reasons, right?
But I
quickly understood, oh, they're all having their own experience of it. They're having their own experience. It's different than mine. And then when someone said, you know, I don't like it, I wasn't inspired, you didn't say anything, I saw their response and the people who loved its response as similar. Everybody, it just isn't mine anymore. It belongs to them. It belongs to them. And it really, to me, it's like watching the thing come to life because it blooms different in everybody's mind, and isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
But you do have to give it away in this other way.
Oh, wow. I think that's a very healthy and probably accurate way to think about it. I'm gonna try to do that.
Oh, I think you're going to be able to, Nate. I will tell you know why I think you'll be able to? Because I was, and I not to heap too much praise on you, but I'm going to do a little bit, because those personal essays showed what I felt is sort of the proper relationship to what I will vaguely call, generally called memoir, meaning you didn't turn yourself into a victim, and you didn't actually turn anybody else into a villain, although there were people who were tricky for you. And it's not easy to balance, but I thought you did a great job of balancing that. And so that shows a good relationship to your identity, because you kind of have to let your identity go when you write personal essay and memoir. And I thought you did a great job of it. So it says to me you've got some reasonably healthy relationship to your ego, I should say.
Well,
it's always tricky.
Yeah, that's fantastic to hear. That's fantastic to hear. So thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. Well, I just a couple more questions. When did you – so every artist has to at some point decide that their stuff is worth saying to other people, stop what you're doing and look at this, right? Whatever it is, you know, sit in the stage or buy this book. When did you decide – it might have been so young that you can't even remember – but that you were funny enough that you were going to have a go at this? Like, I actually know how to be funny. I am a funny guy. Do you remember when that – you settled on that?
Yeah, it wasn't until later, because growing up through high school, I was never the funniest one in my friend group, and I was more student government, and I thought I was going to become a lawyer and then maybe get into politics. And then in college, I loved comedy. I always have, and I love reading, and I've always loved writing, but I think maybe because of the ego thing, I didn't think of myself. I thought, well, yeah, if a fairy came down and said, Nate, you can have any career you want, I would say, yeah, writer, comedian. But I didn't think that it was something that was actually realistic for me. And then slowly over the course of college, I started doing improv with the college improv group. And by the end of it, I just kind of had a slow realization. So maybe not one moment, but it dawned on me. Since this is my favorite thing to do, maybe I shouldn't stop doing it. Maybe I should keep doing the thing that I love more than anything else. So then made the choice to go to New York and try to, quote, make it in comedy, whatever that
means. Yeah, right.
Both writing and performing. And from there, it was kind of off the races. And because I started taking classes at UCB, I was surrounded by people who were submitting their, you know, doing open mics or doing shows or submitting their pieces to McSweeney's. And so it just became a normal thing to do. So it didn't feel as scary. And the rejection felt shared, because everyone was being rejected all the time. And that just felt normal rather than an earth-shattering rejection of my innate ability. It just felt more par for the course. I think I submitted pieces to the New Yorker Daily Shouts, you know, maybe 15 or 20 times before one was chosen. And that just felt almost like a badge of honor, like that you kept going. At a certain point, it probably stops feeling like that. But being in that community really helped.
Well, I love that you said you decided to pursue it because you liked it was the thing you most liked to do. It seems like an obvious choice, but for many people, it's not.
it would seem
impractical. You know, you were going to Harvard, right?
Yes.
At that time, so I'm sure there were people heading off to run the country and to, start businesses, and comedy, not the most practical, quote-unquote, choices, and yet you liked it, and so you went for it. And I think that's awesome.
Thank you. And hey, you know, I'll be honest. There are moments when I see some of the amazing and lucrative fields that my former classmates have chosen, and you can. It's easy to wonder, huh? Maybe I should have studied computer science or engineering or economics or something more practical. But it. All in all, it's been a fun ride so far.
Well, on that note, I have one more question. And what I'd like you to do is finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what? What has it taught you?
Ooh. If writing has taught me anything, it's not to be too precious with ideas, because then you'll never get anything done. So really being okay with the first draft and knowing that you can improve, both specifically in writing, but then I think in life in general, that you're going to have to, if you're worried about running the 5K because you don't think you'll do it fast enough this year, so you put off signing up, then you're just going to be 1 year older when you finally do. So do it this year and have the embarrassing time, and then next year you'll be a little faster. And I think you can do that with everything in life.
Absolutely. Oh, good. Hey, that's good. Matt, I've asked this question probably 1,000 times. That's the first time I've heard that answer, so good on you.
All right.
Well, Nate, it's a funny book, funny book. Again, not quite a genius, great title. Listen, I hope you write another one. I'd love to read it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Take it easy.
Take care.
Yes, you see, don't worry about making mistakes. Don't worry about, there are no such things. You never get it right. You never get it done. There's no mistakes. It's just learning. It's true. It's true. I will be back again next week. As always, I want to thank my intrepid producer, RJ Jeffries. Till then, go out, find something you love to do, and do it.